From Relay, this is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of television. This is episode number 114, recorded March the 6th, 2026. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and I am joined again by Joe Adalian, West Coast editor at Vulture. Joe, welcome back. There's so much going on. I'm glad to have you here.
MC Snell, I guess I have to call you now, Master of Ceremonies. Yeah. Yes, glad to be here. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, that's. I mean, the listeners decided that was my job title back in the Julia era. And so that's what it is now. I go with the listeners. So much to talk about.
Ringleader. Yes.
But the good news is we've exited the painful phase of the Warner Brothers Discovery being sold off and entered a new, perhaps more painful phase. But at least the story has changed. But before we do that,
it has changed, assuming, as I wrote this week, like assuming it really does actually close. And yes, it absolutely looks like it will. And the administration is greasing the wheels for it. But yeah, never know.
You never know. And I think it's we're going to talk about it. But before we do that, I would like to talk about Netflix and Apple a little bit, because before people don't get to hear us talk before we start the podcast, because that's not how podcasting works. We love Apple TV and wonder, like, Apple should do more with the hardware and Apple should make more deals and it should be more aggressive at being a viewing tracker and all of that. And one of the big problems that Apple faces is that Apple and Netflix cannot come to an agreement on sharing data in any way, which means that if you want to use Apple's TV app to track all of your shows, you can do all of your shows except for Netflix, anything on Netflix. It's just not there. And this came up and I said, well, I should at least mention that the Formula One season starts this weekend. And in a very unusual and interesting deal, logical, but still surprising given how they seem to be at loggerheads elsewhere, Netflix and Apple made a deal regarding F1. Now, Netflix has the very popular reality show Drive to Survive, which is a sports doc about F1, and they just released a new season that is all about last season of F1. Apple has the U.S. rights to F1 now. Starting this weekend. So they made a deal, and the latest season of Drive to Survive in the US also is available on Apple TV, and there will be a race in May that will also be available, again, in the US, available on Netflix, that Netflix will be able to show a live race in addition to Apple showing it. So they did a little quid pro quo, a little content swap, and I think it's smart because in the U.S., they are the two stewards of Formula One at this point. So getting along is probably not a bad idea. Netflix sees some upside in driving more people to be excited about F1 and watch other seasons of Drive to Survive. They also get to have a little live sports experiment in exchange by having Apple throw that race, which is in Canada. So it'll be at a good time when people in the U.S. might actually watch it live. And they'll see what happens. I only bring this up in this context of this show to say, it would be really nice, this is the obligatory thing, is since you're all getting along so well, can you bury the hatchet and find a way to work together on Apple's platforms? Because I think it would be beneficial to everybody. And I don't know what the policy issues are. There's been a lot of talk about, like, Netflix doesn't want to share viewing data with Apple, or there's certain data that Apple wants. And then the overall feeling that Netflix is like, why would we put our content with other people's content instead of, like, saying just be inside Netflix? Well, actually,
Jason, let me interrupt you here for a second, sir. And they do that. They allow that latter argument doesn't hold water, because if you have a Roku device, you can track your Netflix shows.
See, that's
in the much harder to use What's Up Next. Same thing, I believe, with Google. So it's something about whatever
Apple and Netflix are doing together that they can't come to agreement. Oh, yes, please.
Well, I was told years ago, maybe 6-7 years ago, by people on the product side at Netflix, or maybe no, it was, I think maybe it was someone at Roku who's sort of heard it. So it's a sort of third hand, but, Roku and Netflix, you know, at one point were part of the same company, but they sort of have a genesis somehow.
Roku did the original streaming box, which was the Netflix player. It was literally called the Netflix player.
And so it's very easy, but with the terms of, in order to build it, I've been told by people inside Netflix, Apple is so niche, it's such a small percentage, it would mean building all sorts of code and all sorts of stuff on their end, and they're just like, screw that, it's not worth it, whatever. Which, if you were any other company other than Netflix, I would say, okay, well, you know, Peacock certainly isn't going to do this because they're too tiny, although they could use every subscriber. Maybe Netflix is just, I don't know if that was just spin, but they're Netflix. They have enough engineers to like, you know, do whatever they want.
That's not it, because last year there was a brief hiccup where the Netflix stuff all started to show up. So it's done.
So maybe they've actually, maybe they finally though done it, and it's on a roadmap, and they've done it. Yeah. And
so I think what's left is the negotiations, because I think everybody at Apple's probably like, we don't want to give you this data. And Netflix is like, but we want that data, or the reverse. Apple wants to know and Netflix doesn't want to share. Like, I get why there's some strategic issues here, but what bugs me is both products are worse. Both sets of customers are worse off, that they don't get along. And so, you know, I know it's not connected, but since you are all so nice and sharing Formula One content, could we maybe bury the hatchet and just say, let's do what's right for our customers? It would be nice. I don't think it's going to happen.
I would watch so much more Netflix.
I know.
You know?
I forget. I was just watching Netflix show the other day, and I was like, and I opened the Apple TV, and I'm like, am I watching something on Netflix? And I had to, I am using an app now. I'm using an app called Television Time to do more tracking. And it's in there, obviously, because those apps can have everything in there. But I had a moment where I was just staring at my Apple TV screen thinking, do I have a Netflix show to watch right now? And I did, but I just, you know, it's so easy to just pick what's in front of me and not go over to Netflix.
And it's tough for me because I'm someone who likes to, you know, actually do slow binges of certain shows once a week. I'm currently watching, you know, a couple seasons ago of Emily in Paris and still finishing up Grace and Frankie, or Frankie and Grace, whatever the hell it's called, and the final season. And so I generally set a date for myself to watch it every Sunday night, but sometimes I forget because I forget, and it's sort of very annoying.
Wouldn't
so.
It be nice? And also Netflix shows tend to do, they drop in a binge and then it's gone for a year or two. Wouldn't it be nice if like Outlander just showed up on my Apple TV today because the new season is starting and it's been ages, but I do want to know that. I'm going to do the thing. My wife actually said yesterday, oh yeah, there's a new Outlander season. Well, you know, Jason will sign up for it for a month and we'll watch it all and then we'll cancel it. And usually there's a really good deal on Stars, so you can get it for like 3 months for $5 and then you cancel and you've spent $5 to watch that. But again, great reminder, great marketing for Stars that the show comes back. Netflix could use that too. And I know they're so big. Oh, we don't need it. But it's like, well, I mean, it wouldn't hurt, right? Like, also, I'm heartened by the idea that like they wouldn't do live sports. They wouldn't do ads. There's lots of things Netflix wouldn't do. And when given a good reason, they do it. And I hope that they and Apple will get together on this at some point.
Same.
So frustrating. Because otherwise that Apple TV box experience is really great.
Well, and which leads to the start of the question that began this whole conversation we had in the pre-show experience that we have here. It's very fancy.
It's very limited. It's just you and me.
Exactly. But there, you know, you put out hors d'oeuvres and there's, you know, it's a very nice environment, soft music. But anyway, you know, can we please get a new updated Apple TV box? And also, can Apple get serious about getting this into more Americans' hands? Because they've got the best streaming box out there and they need to just market it more aggressively, do something, but at least update it. It's been 4 years now. We're going on 4 years since an update. It'll be nice because I'd like to buy a new one.
Yeah, same.
Take my money.
I know. Shut up and take my money. Okay, let's move on to the main topic of this whole episode, which is going to be Warner Brothers Discovery and what happened. So here's what happened. I'll recap for you here. Finally, Skydance, Paramount, David Ellison, Larry Ellison, they upped their offer finally after all this time to an offer, and Netflix was like, look, have them make a final offer. We're going to let you talk to them for a week, and then when they make their offer, we'll get 4 days to decide if we want to match it or not. And then because Netflix was in the first position, they had accepted Netflix's offer, and Paramount raised their guarantees as well as the price, and said that they would pay off the breakup fee with Netflix and write Netflix a check for $2.7 billion. And so they did that. And Netflix, if you hear Ted Sarandos tell it, Netflix had already worked out when they walk away. And so when they saw what the offer was, they're like, nope, we're not going to match it. And he said, you know, we thought it was nice to have at the offer we made. We said it was our best offer. We weren't kidding. We're not going to get into a bidding war. It doesn't make sense for us above this. And he walked away. And as a result, you know, David Ellison wins and Paramount is going to merge with Warner Brothers Discovery. He gets everything. He also gets the cable networks, which he did not want them to spin off. And we'll get into all of this, but that's what happened. And I thought, I wanted to start, just before we get on to the David Ellison of it all, to talk about Netflix's position here, because, you know, I have complained a lot about a lot of Netflix's content decisions and their pricing decisions and a lot of things. But throughout this process, I have been nothing but impressed with how this has gone, where I think Ted Sarandos and company saw an opportunity to own a bunch of intellectual property and to get into the movie studio business and the movie distribution business and expand what it meant to be Netflix. But they also seem to be really disciplined and not willing to do what a person with unlimited funds would be able to do. And clearly, if Larry Ellison wanted to give his kid more money, they were going to win the bidding. There was no doubt about it. And Netflix sort of went into it in a disciplined fashion and said, we're willing to do this. I believe them that they're like, we're not going to go further. And in fact, like the moment that it came in, they didn't wait 4 days. They were like, nope, that's it. Good luck. And they stepped away. So, I admire that, because there are a lot of mergers, a lot of purchases that happen in business in general, where you can see that it's the ego getting ahead of the business sense and people making bad decisions. And I think Netflix made a really good decision. There was a piece in Puck by William Cohan a couple days before this all went down, where he basically said, don't do it, Ted. and it was a persuasive argument that it was becoming increasingly a bad business decision. And I like that Ted Sarandos is like, I'm a big enough boy to just say, nope, we're not going to spend that. Good luck to them, and walk away.
That's the most positive for Ted scenario. And I don't necessarily disagree with it. What I don't know is how much of this was also looking at the stock price, looking at that reaction columns like that, and saying, maybe we risking too much.
The stock price made it clear that the investors in Netflix didn't like the deal, right?
Right. And then the question becomes, what do you listen to? And look, I sort of talked myself into believing that they were going to up their deal, that they were going to go for this, that they could do this. It was a holy war. That was dumb. Obviously, they have to be smart. I actually think the deal would have had a lot of upside for Netflix and Warner Brothers.
Absolutely.
It made a lot of sense in so many ways.
The better deal in every way except the one that mattered. We should say, swirling around here has been like, is the government going to approve it? Is Trump like it and all of that?
That was the big wild card.
A very funny story where, again, you got to take him at his word, but Ted Sarandos said, I talked to Donald Trump and he said, I'm just worried about CNN. And he said, we're not going to buy CNN. CNN's not going to be part of this. And he's like, oh, well, then I don't care. So, like, I mean, I still believe that the Ellisons convinced themselves that they were going to get this because they had been friendly with people in the administration. And I think the people in the administration would have left them hanging. And I think they came to realize that, which is why their initial bid for Warner Brothers Discovery was half of what they ended up spending.
No, exactly. And that's the thing is, even if you believe that there's also a conspiracy theory that says that Ted and Netflix and even Zaslav all got together and said, let's make these boys pay more money.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we can, and we can scare them. And even the whole sort of salesmanship campaign, the out there aggressively, if you're engaged in a game of chicken, you got to make the other side think you were willing to go to the mat. And then they didn't. So yes, it's absolutely possible that David got played and he just ended up spending a lot more. And in the long term, he will be weaker. But at the same time, it's a long game, and we'll talk more about this. Who knows how it will ultimately, he's getting a lot. But it definitely, as I said, like, there was no real scenario, honestly, where Netflix could lose by being this disciplined, because they have now walked away with $3 billion. They got to see Warner Brothers books. They got a peek into that whole thing. They made what looked like an inevitability from Paramount into something where it's a lot harder for them to make the deal work sense. So they're weakened. So, on the one hand, yes, this new company is stronger than it was had it just been Paramount. And that gives, the new company a chance to succeed and get closer to Netflix than they might have otherwise. But doing so is going to require a lot more pain, going to cost a lot more money, and take a lot more time. So in that sense, Netflix won. So yeah, I there will be other, Ted and his in talking. Well, I'll let you talk.
Yeah. before we get off of Netflix, because before we get to the other side of it, I think there's a lot of really interesting Netflix angles here. And yes, I do firmly believe that whether they conspired or not, like, Zaslav and Ted Sarandos basically got David Ellison and his dad to pay twice as much as they were going to pay for this thing, plus write Netflix a $2.7 billion check for their trouble. And it is, and it's what they wanted. And I'm not saying that there was like it was a scam or something. I'm just saying in the end, Netflix being bold and being interested cost the Ellisons an awful lot. Before we move on to the ramifications for Paramount and Warner Brothers, though, I have one other thought. This is my conspiracy theory thought a little bit, Joe, but I wanted to put it past you, which is now, okay, a few things. Now that Netflix has spent a few months thinking about other aspects of their business or businesses that they're not in, right? They showed the flexibility to change how they think about theatrical. I've never believed that Ted Sarandos is fundamentally an enemy of theatrical. I think he never saw it as making sense for the business he was in, and that this was an indication that if he was in the theatrical distribution business, he could build a different feeder network for Netflix content that would also be a bigger studio and a theatrical distribution business. So my wild theory is, in an era where we're essentially, I mean, we can debate it, but we're essentially going to lose a movie studio because there's Paramount and Warner Brothers are going to be owned by the same company. They can say what they want, but we saw what happened with Fox and Disney. You're basically losing a movie studio, and there will be one fewer major movie studio in Hollywood. Ted Sarandos also just got almost $3 billion in a check from the Ellisons for his trouble. I wouldn't put it past Netflix to consider if they actually do want to ramp up other aspects of their business that you would never have expected last year. I'm not saying that they might say, "What? Maybe we should get into theatrical," but I'm not saying they might not if they thought that it made sense. I feel like they are positioned to do whatever they think makes sense for them, and we've seen when they added ads and when they added live events that they're willing to make changes in order to follow an opportunity. And I wonder if they're going to look at the consolidation and the cuts that are going to be required over on the other side at Warner Brothers and Paramount and think it might be a business opportunity for them to pick up some other properties or to even, he said, we're builders and not buyers generally, or even build something new in order to take advantage of the fact that there are going to be a lot of people out of work and there's going to be a little bit of a gap in the market because this one studio is going to go away. And I'm just saying, I don't put it past Netflix to surprise us again in some way and take advantage of the fact that you've got this competitor who is now loaded down with debt.
Absolutely, that's possible. There's Comcast is something that could still be out there in a few years as a possible acquisition contract. But the other thing is something far less than having kids. But they don't want NBC, most likely.
No, they don't
want all that. Okay, these are, although it's slimmed down, but on the other hand, maybe there's a partnership with Universal Pictures. They've already got they've got sort of like these output deals and Peacock's there, but maybe Peacock goes away or Peacock changes and then and maybe Peacock just somehow folds in NBC somehow and becomes the place, where next day stuff goes on Netflix or maybe Netflix uses that $3 billion and sort of seeds sort of a partnership to form a sort of a standalone studio that sort of is built
right
to make a made for theatrical movies, but Universal distributes them and they take a little bit of a cut off the top. I don't know. There are different, certainly I would not be surprised to see new ways of thinking about this. Apple could do the same thing too.
They've been spending months thinking about new ways of doing business involving getting Warner Brothers. Maybe they'll put all those thoughts on ice, but like surely they've had some interesting ideas about this business that they didn't have before, and they might do something with that.
Right. And the thing is also, depending upon what sort of output deals they can get from other companies, Paramount is proven that it does a lot of output deals and selling content. Maybe I keep thinking like, why is does Netflix, how long do they want to keep making big budget movies like The Rip without any sort of theatrical, advertising, without sort of increasing it? They've been successful. I just don't understand. Like to me, when movies like The Kissing Booth or K-pop Demon Hunters that they spend so little on or just anime can do so well and prove so durable, it's not 15 years ago. You don't have to give Adam Sandler or Ben Affleck tons of money to do these massive movies because I don't see the upside long term. It's an investment, but I feel like they look at the data, they see the data, maybe it does enough and has enough value because people love first run movies. One of the biggest reasons people got HBO in the linear cable era was for first run movies. So having access to first run movies or the first window is really important. And, you know, Netflix wants to have a lot of them. They want them internationally, and they can only do so many deals, you know, like they really can't do first window with any studio. I think maybe except Sony now they have first window, but everywhere else, yeah, it's sort of like it's second to Peacock or whatever. And so, you know, I think you're right that there could be some changes to their.
They're really smart, and they did spend months thinking about this, and they had their reasons for buying it. And I know some of that was just opportunistic, but I don't know what they will do, but I would not be surprised at all if you see Netflix make some really interesting moves over the next couple of years, because they have gone through the thought process of other aspects that they could add to their business that they don't currently have. And they've shown that they're incredibly flexible when it comes to that. I should also mention as a footnote, they did actually buy a company that was a startup in stealth that was owned by Ben Affleck the other day.
They did, yeah.
It's really interesting because it's an AI startup, but it's about building AI models based on shot footage that the filmmakers bring, train a model, and then they use it as a tool. It's basically a filmmaker-driven AI model for filmmaking. And so the pitch is it's like the right way to use AI in a film process. And a friend of mine actually works at the company. I didn't even know until yesterday, because he's like, well, we were in stealth, but I guess I work for Netflix now. And, you know, I think that's an interesting example where is that some Ellison money that they dropped on that company? I don't know. Probably not. But I just think Netflix will continue to do interesting things. And hard to imagine that this wasn't a little bit of a creative boost to them, even though they didn't get the prize in the end. So we'll see what they do. I think Netflix is a fascinating company. They are a leader, and they're going to continue to be a leader, and we'll just have to watch and see what they do next. So I'm going to put off like the nitty gritty of what happens at the company to say, I wanted to pause and talk about the fact that Hollywood seemed so shocked by the rapid change that happened where Netflix pulled out. People were stunned. There was a lot of talk about it. There was a lot of stories about people being horrified. And I feel like those people didn't listen to Downstream because I think a lot of people just were failing to look two moves ahead. And they're like, no, Netflix is bad. We don't like Netflix. They don't like movie theaters. Netflix is bad. I hope that this doesn't work. Not thinking about the fact that the only reason this deal was happening is because the alternative was going to be that David Ellison was going to buy them. There's not realistically a path. It could still happen, but like to them not having a sale, like the whole idea, everything David Zaslav has been trying to do was to have a sale of Warner Brothers Discovery. And so when Hollywood had that moment of shock, I was like, this is why the Netflix deal was a better deal for everybody. And you should have thought about that and been realistic about it. I guess there's some idealism going on there, but anyway, it is, you know, it's a done deal. I mean, although to your point, we don't know. Everything seems to be on the way. You never know. Something might come up. Something might scotch the deal. They might have to make some changes in the deal. Who knows? Like David Zaslav was quoted the other day as saying, like, you know, if that happens, they'll write us a big check and we will move along. Nobody expects it, but you never know if it might happen. But I think we have to accept that it's the most likely scenario now.
And I would just like to, when we're fast forward to probably at least 2 years, because, you know, if this deal closes for the first year or so, I think you will see sort of like that, you know, a big output of movies for both Paramount and Warner Brothers, because stuff will already have been in the pipeline, right? And they're not going to shelve a whole bunch of stuff. But maybe 2 or 3 years from now, I would love to go get comment from Jim Cameron, who was sort of like, Netflix cannot own Paramount and there are Warner Brothers and it'll be horrible. And when they dramatically downsize one or two of the studios or their slates get much, much smaller, because they will. There's no way going forward they're going to release 30 movies a year on a regular going basis, or maybe even 20 movies a year. And there is consolidation here. You don't need that many movies if you're one company, and certainly not at the big blockbuster level. And it's be careful. You know, all the hate because of the fact that in your mind Netflix doesn't kiss up to theater chains enough. You know, no one, again, and I've said this, I believe, on this show or other podcasts, that it just, you know, you cannot ignore the fact that in the same way that network station owners and affiliates have held back network TV and insisting on all sorts of restrictions on what can go on streaming and when and how and what you can promote and what you can't. Theater owners have been the same way in realizing that people watch movies in different ways and you have different audiences for home viewing and movies. If a movie is good, it doesn't matter if it comes out 2 weeks later. People are going to go to movie theaters to see it. It's because it's the theatrical experience. The window has shrunk for so many movies, and yet they insist on 45 days for Netflix when so many other movies are purchase 15 days later. And the theater chains have not done enough themselves to invest in the theater going experience. It's a crappy experience. It costs a lot of money. You got to pay for lots of food. They don't control the crowd, so the crowds are out of control. People have amazing 70-inch TV screens that can, you can't put your head in the sand and just say that the reason that people aren't going to movie theaters is because of this one company, Netflix. It's also TV got better. It's streaming got better. People spend more time playing video games now than ever before. They do virtual reality. They're on all these different things that I have no idea what they are, Minecraft, Roblox, whatever the heck they are, right? So you've got competition. You can't pin it all on Netflix. If Ted Sarandos and the folks at Netflix hadn't come around, someone else would have had the big streaming company. It's technology. Get over it. Sure. And I'm not saying Netflix has been perfect and that they haven't also been difficult and they couldn't concede a little bit more.
Sure.
But when you're going to say you're not going to run their movies in theaters, when Netflix says, yes, we'll put this movie in theaters, but we want it to be on our homes a week later because we're going to spend a lot of money on marketing. We want to have effect. We don't want to wait 8 weeks later and then have to do a whole other marketing campaign.
Ted Sarandos, one of the things he said is as a part of the run up to buying Warner Brothers, which didn't happen, he talked to a lot of people in movie theaters, right, where they had a different conversation than they used to have.
Right.
And he said, and again, this is just Ted Sarandos says a lot of things. So we'll take him at his word. But like you got to be aware that he's going to come from his perspective. But what he said was he had good conversations with the movie theater industry and that he can see how that has changed his perspective. And there are ways that they maybe will work together in ways that they hadn't before. And again, maybe that's just diplomacy. Maybe it's lips. Service, but going back to my previous point, I kind of believe that there was a rethinking. I mean, there was a reset of relationships because everybody thought this was what was going to happen. I would think that a residue of that will probably lead to some different approaches. Also, when you couple in things like how Netflix has had some great success with K-pop Demon Hunters going back into theaters for big events and stuff like that, and that would have been probably a big hit in theatrical, maybe not, who knows, but like enough positivity there that maybe this all leads to a little bit of a reset on all sides, thinking about how Netflix and movie theaters work together.
Yeah, and by some of the theater chains get weaker and weaker. AMC is like probably going to be maybe potentially in bankruptcy again or some other thing. So it just, it's in there. And I think they're finally realizing, all right, we can sort of bend a little bit too. But we shall see.
We shall see. Okay, the big thing then is what's going to happen on the other side. Jerry Cardinale, who's one of the Redbird Investments, is one of the people involved in this purchase, said, he's been around going like, oh, it won't be so bad. It might not be so bad. It's what's out there and what people are saying is a little too much. Ted Sarandos is saying it's going to be harder than it is and all of that, but it's hard not to see how this is going to be bad. It is super leveraged. One of the reasons they wanted to keep the cable properties is that the cable properties, even though cable revenue is kind of in free fall, it's still a generator of revenue that can help pay down debt. This is the Zaslav plan. Zaslav's great success before the sale was paying down a lot of debt on the Discovery takeover or purchase of Warner's, but now they have to do it again in the combined company with way more debt. So I think that's the challenge here is it's easy to see the redundancies and it's easy to see the size of the debt. And, maybe they won't care as much about the debt and that this is more, it's the rationality question that I have, which is if it's the world's richest man and his kid having fun building a business in Hollywood, maybe they don't care as much about the debt as other people might. So it's hard to judge, but looking at this as a business, it's going to be rough. Like if it's run like a real business, it feels like it's going to be really rough.
It's going to be rough. One person that I spoke to noted that, even though they're technically a publicly traded company, they're mostly controlled by the Ellisons, family run. And, there's something that says you've already spent this much money. you could sort of say, like, I'm going to ride out for 5 years from now. And right. you have to, you know, I think someone told me something like it's like $4 billion a year, it's or $4 billion a month or something. But in terms of the debt payment, they've got to pay their debt payment. And right. something that, whatever that is. So $4 billion a year, a month, whatever it is. I think it's a year. So there's obviously going to be massive cuts. But maybe you say, you know what, if we're serious about taking a run at Netflix, we're going to do what Netflix did, which was ignore the debt and mm-hmm. keep spending and doing what we need to until we're big enough that we can actually, you know, show results. And so Comcast fades away. And, you know, maybe that's what
everybody
they
else gets out of the game if they don't have the money to be in the game. Yeah, maybe.
But not everybody else. I mean, Disney's not going anywhere. And, sure. And, you know, but
sure.
You
but
know.
you could raise the bet to the point where then a bunch of the smaller players are like, I'm out. Right.
Right.
Like,
and so, you know, there's some possibility there. But it, even if the worst case scenario is there's just going to be so much consolidation. Yeah. They're going to be on the studio side. There's three different TV studios, multiple movie studios. It's going to be a lot. And on the streaming side as well. I mean, you know, the product teams are going to be decimated at one of these companies. So it's going to be a lot of pain.
Yeah, a lot of people are going to lose their jobs and presumably the amount of production, even if they end up with an ambitious slate of movies and of streaming content. It's almost impossible to imagine it will not be down probably quite a bit from the combined output of Paramount and Warner Brothers today, right?
Yeah, I mean, going to like they just looking for, you know, CBS will continue to do what CBS does, but for Paramount Plus and HBO Max, like the cable networks basically make no original content, so that's not going to change much, you know, and it'll just move, but there'll be two different sports divisions, CBS Sports and TNT Sports, so you're going to have to figure that out, so there's going to be layoffs right. there.
There's
and,
some
and
complimentary, there'll be cuts, but there's some complimentary stuff going between those
Well, in
two,
terms so. Of these sports, but like not in terms of like the actual production and all that.
Exactly.
And then, you know, yeah, in terms of shows, it's like, you know, you've already got HBO Max making sort of their version of sort of, you know, their Taylor Sheridan show is The Pit and some mm-hmm. other shows like that and the superhero show. So, you know, it's 1 + 1 is not going to equal 3 in terms of content, unless their plan is to sort of try to maximize the amount of revenue and sort of make it so that, you know, maybe there's a little bit of discount if you subscribe to both Paramount Plus and an HBO Max on one platform, but you're still, you know, paying, you're going to pay like $35 a month. I don't think that's what they're going to try to do. I think they're going to make less content, cut the price so that it's more than what Paramount's getting now, a little bit, maybe roughly the same what it is for HBO Max. And yeah, it's, I you know, it can't see in a scenario where we don't get less content, less shows a year from now.
So we also have to talk about the dilemma of HBO, right? Because they've come out and said, David Ellison, so we love HBO, we love Casey Bloys, you know, great, keep doing what they're doing, we value the HBO brand. You wrote a great piece on Vulture and in the Buffering newsletter about the challenge, though, because it's like, hey, that's the right thing to do, right? Is to say, we value you. You are an important brand. But then your story is like, okay, but what happens next? Because Paramount Skydance already has a head of development whose job contains an awful lot of what you might say Casey Bloys' job is for HBO and HBO Max. And so you made the point like, something is going to give here. And if you really want to retain Casey Bloys, but you've also just got your new executive, Cindy
Holland, who used Holland. To run. She was basically Ted Sarandos' number two in person.
Right,
she's sort of the person who built the content
so
that
what
Netflix
gives?
Launched on.
Like, can you have these people, like, even if you like them both, their current jobs kind of overlap in a bunch of ways. So like, how do you make that work?
It's a matter of David Ellison and Cindy also focusing on what they think HBO is and what they think Casey Bloys wants to do. And that'll be a conversation. And Casey isn't officially talking at all. And everyone's sort of staying quiet. There need to be conversations. Mm-hmm. But you know, Casey, HBO, like there's some people who were saying, oh, well, HBO is just going to be the little premium thing on this new super app, sort of like FX is, or,
sure.
you know, it'll be a little.
That's what Netflix would have done with HBO is upsell to get the HBO.
Yes, but see, with with Netflix, because they have so much content,
yes,
so broad and so many subscribers, they could have essentially imported most of HBO Max and that whole team over. Like, you could have sort of Bella Bajaria and her team, and you could have Casey Bloy's team.
Because Paramount can't do that, because in the end, because the remit is larger than just HBO. It is more HBO Max, and that's where the overlap happens. Is if you stuff Casey Bloy's back in the HBO bottle, he's lost a large part of
a third of his mandate, right, and his team and everything else and what they do, and also what the brand equity of HBO Max is. So, you know, they recently just, you know, they, even before they closed the deal for Paramount, you know, David Ellison went out and he got Cindy Holland to sort of be his streaming guru. And, you know, not that Cindy was sort of like, she was at an independent production company. So since she's left Netflix, it's not like she immediately took a job somewhere else running someone else's streaming division. She's sort of purposeful about what she wanted to do. But this was her chance to get back into a job that let her not just run the creative for Paramount Plus, but also actually oversee the entire app, the business strategy, integrating Pluto into it, sort of the whole Paramount streaming operation. So big job. But we all know, everyone in town knows, Cindy Holland is mostly a creative person. She is there to focus on the creative. They've got a chief product officer that they brought in that, you know, reports into Ellison too and technically works with Cindy, but like, she's focused on that. So you've got this big coup sort of scene, and she's already set up about a dozen projects, her and her team. She recruited some people, I think, who used to be at Netflix, maybe at HBO Max, I'm not sure. You know, so she's doing her thing, sort of going out to the community like, I'm getting the big star. She's getting Nicole Kidman and Anne Hathaway and all those names when you're trying to make a splash as a new regime. And so she's there, but then you've got Casey, and suddenly it's like, well, do you need both? It's sort of like, dude, now they might think again that they can, but like, they need to talk to Casey, and Casey needs to talk to Cindy, and they need to figure out, like the mature adults that they are, and say, like, does this make sense? Is there room in this popsicle stand for both of us? It could be that there is. People that I've sort of talked to informally and around Hollywood think it doesn't make sense. Casey is, you know, even if you sort of allow Casey to report directly to David Ellison, which could happen, right?
Because Barry Weiss, you know, does that.
Right? Barry Weiss reports directly to him, even though like George Cheeks runs CBS. So there's a possibility. But the thing is, there's no one else doing CBS News, right? There's no one, there's not a, you know, at, it, right. You know, it's the same thing. Not yet. We'll talk more about that. There's going to be CNN, but it's sort of the same thing. So they got to get in a room. And so it's early days, but I do expect, you know, as this gets closer to closing, potentially as soon as the end of the summer, you're going to have these real conversations, and they'll decide, okay, can we figure this out? What does autonomy mean? And what does it, and it speaks, I didn't get into this in the piece because I wanted to focus it, but it gets into sort of just the whole thing of what this new Paramount Plus super streamer will be. They want to compete with Netflix. Well, just how big is it going to be? What price point do they want it to be? And also things like, what do you call it? Do you call it HBO Max or do you call it Paramount Plus? There's a big argument that says you should just learn from David Zaslav's mistakes. You've got a brand identity. Keep HBO in there. On the other hand, internationally, HBO doesn't mean as much. Does Paramount? I don't think so, but they've built some brand equity around the world with Paramount Plus. So do you, you know, they have to figure that out. And that again will come down to egos and everything else. You know, there's a, you know, they have to solve that problem, sort of, you know, and then figure out what, you know, what the library of this new thing is going to be. You know, how much of it are they just going to sort of, you know, HBO Max has sort of very quietly over the last year and a half really focused its brand and its offering. They got rid of a lot of Discovery Channel stuff. They narrowed down the sort of development that they, original shows they made. They got out of the kids TV business and they said, this is what we're going to do. Now, this new streamer, that doesn't necessarily mean that like this new streamer, you know, might not want to revisit that. Like, For Paramount Plus with HBO Max, it probably does make sense to have kids because you're going to have Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network, right? Yeah. So, and Warner Brothers. So do you revisit that in a way that what didn't make sense? So does that open up opportunities sort of for stuff for Cindy to focus on? Do you, what about the CBS of it all? Which again, I will yell as loudly as possible, like, you know, a big part of what works on Peacock is stuff from NBC. A big part of what works on Hulu, Disney Plus is ABC content. And you've got the same person who oversees Hulu's originals, also oversees ABC's originals. Well, you've also got CBS that really needs to be part of this conversation in a way that it hasn't till now. And, you know, to me, I would put George Cheeks in all of it and have George Cheeks maybe reported to Casey, but he's not going to because he's been a CEO too. So they've got, there's still a whole bunch of mess there and they need to figure that the heck out.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch. Casey, it feels to me like Casey Bloys has an awful lot of leverage right now.
He does.
Because there is a perception, and you see it when David Ellison says how much they love HBO and they value HBO and what Casey is doing over there. This is the last thing you want to do when you spend this much money on an organization like this
is lose,
is to
Casey
break
Bloys.
It. Right? Like yeah. Break it when you walk in the door. You want to be seen as being, it's not just like, I want to feel like people think I'm a good person because I'm a steward of this thing. It's also like, why did you buy this thing and then destroy it? Right? Like the whole point is to keep the good stuff that you bought. And if you destroy HBO in the process of buying it, what did you do? So Casey Bloys is in a pretty good position here.
I mean, I think as soon as one of the first things I thought when the Netflix thing fell apart and it was Paramount, I said, well, Casey Bloys' quote just went up, right? His contract is up. He can be able to ask for a whole lot more money, you know. And by the way, though, Paramount could say, thanks, we're fine, you know, it's absolutely possible.
They
but
could.
Again, and because look, I love Casey Bloys is a great executive. I mean, it is one of his biggest accomplishments to me is, you know, we've talked for so many years about why doesn't streaming figure out how to make network style shows that cost what network style shows cost and that run for 15 or 20 episodes and that people watch every week, and streamers, instead of spending like $10 million an episode on this prestige thing that no one watches and disappears after season, he goes and with Warner Brothers in tandem with them, the good people over there, they create The Pit and they're tripling down on that. They've got two other shows that are like it. That's really smart. So Casey Bloys has proven he's not just a little niche developer.
Right.
So, you don't want to lose that. But on the other hand, you know, HBO existed before Casey Bloys and it was a very strong brand with Richard Plepler and other people. But of course, that was also during the heyday of cable and when HBO didn't have a lot of competition, right?
I don't want to say that Casey Bloys is irreplaceable. I'm just saying that like it would be and he may choose. It's just going to be a bad look. And so I think Ellison is going to be motivated to try and retain him in any way
Make
possible. I do think that there's definitely scenarios where he thinks now's a good time for me to do something else and get out if he doesn't get what he wants. But he does have a lot of leverage. And you're right. You are absolutely right to bring out CBS in this, because that's the other part of this. This is a big company with a lot of different branches now. And the idea that you've got a network that can feed content back to you, but that also you could develop content for, you know, Casey Bloys being really great at developing The Pit is great. You know what's really great when you're developing network style shows is a network to develop them for, right? And they're going to have one with CBS. So what does that all mean, though, in terms of and this is the part that is you can't really math it out. It's egos. It's like what does Casey Bloys think that his territory should be? And all the Cindy Holland, what does she think her territory should be? What does George Cheeks think? Like, that's the hard stuff, is the people, because you can have something that makes sense perfectly for your organization, but like, if the people don't like it, they're not going to do it. It's going to be something to watch. And I will say again, Netflix, Disney, Apple, Amazon, there are sharks in the water. Sony as well, right? Even though Sony's playing a different game, like, there are places that these very talented people could go. So that's also a part of the calculation. Also interesting, right? Coming from Sony, what a good opportunity for them to have a little more of a platform. Anyway, that's another story about how well they've executed at Apple, but I think it's an overlooked story about how good the content is and what a good job they've done there. I get that Apple's got lots of money to spend and all of that. And they've been given a safe environment where they're not going to be treated as maybe as harshly as some of the publicly held entertainment only streamers are. But anyway, Plepler, interesting that he's involved. Zach and Jamie did a great job, no matter whoever hired them. Good call, good hire. Anyway, so that's all there. We'll have to just wait and see. But like, you never know where these people, man. Like, I learned this as a manager for many years. It's like, you can do something that you think is a win-win and everybody gets something out of it and everybody looks good. And then one of the people will be like, I'm offended by this. I'm not going to do it. And you're like, okay. Yeah. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, people don't always know this, but big TV executives at Casey's level have agents of their own who sort of look after them, yeah, and shepherd them and get them jobs. And that's probably how Zach and Jamie got their jobs, was whoever represents them. My understanding is Casey's rep by William Morris Endeavor and no one other than Ari Emanuel. So you've got someone out there looking after his best interests. And by the way, Cindy might also too. So there could be a conflict there. But the thing is, whatever happens is, you know, there's a lot of leverage.
Yeah. And
he's got some smart people and powerful people.
These are not amateurs. These are people with agents. And that's part of it too. And the ego, I mean, Hollywood, I know it's a cliche, but like, I mean, ego is true at everywhere. It's just magnified at Hollywood. That's the truth. Cause I talk about like an editor for a tech magazine that I would have been managing saying, no, this offends me, I'm not going to do it. Like, that is not a Hollywood diva. That's just a human being, but it is human nature. Like, people are motivated by different things and they have value in different things. And at any level, you could have something where it's like, you know, Casey Bloys, we think that this is great and honors you and it's going to give you this huge territory. And Casey Bloys and his agent look at it and say, actually it's kind of feels like a demotion or a sideways move. And why would we do that? We don't want to do it. And it's like that, if they feel that way, it's very hard. It's very hard to deal with it. People have their feelings.
It's going to be interesting. By the way, I have to ask you one quick question. Yeah. What do you think this new super platform should be called? Should it be called Paramount Plus or should it be called HBO Max?
I think, okay, you put me on the spot here.
Or a third option.
So step one is how is this structured? Because if it is structured as a single thing, it's a different name than if it's structured as multiple things. And I do wonder if their plan is going to be to do something like Disney Plus and Hulu with HBO still and say, we're going to have a premium tier of content that's HBO that you could subscribe to that's in addition to the broad content of the service.
But the thing is, the combined Disney Plus Hulu is really one bundled price, right? So it's not,
you can get them separately,
but they don't market it that way. They're marketing get Disney Plus. That's what's going to be going forward. It's like, get Disney Plus, you also get this, because it's only a dollar difference. So it's not really a premium. Whereas Paramount Plus with Showtime, remember that god awful thing, Premium and they Showtime shows that are nothing on it, right?
If we assume that the goal is a one-stop shop for all their content, I think they should call it HBO, not HBO Max, not HBO Plus, just call it HBO. It's the best brand they own, and I would just go with it.
I would keep HBO Max. It's what works now.
It's fine.
And the Max would mean
Paramount.
By the way, CBS? It's not going to be everything, because what they've all realize this, there's a lot of stuff out there that people aren't going to pay for or want to watch, or that's not worth charging. So even though all of us as consumers, don't you want to get every Cartoon Network show and every Discovery Channel show? That's nice. You're not getting that. You can go watch that on Pluto, or watch that, which is, by the way, going to be on this app for free with lots and lots and lots of ads. Or you could, maybe we'll sell it to Tubi, or maybe we'll sell some stuff to Netflix, or to Roku or whoever. So you're not going to get that. So your offering it should be sort of the offering, as some people I've talked to have said it, like basically what HBO Max is now, but we're going to give you a little more sports and we're going to give you the Taylor Sheridan shows, because that's premium and that's great and you can't get anywhere else. And we're going to give you South Park and that's it.
Okay.
And it costs a lot. And if you want ad free with some extra stuff, maybe you want some movies sooner than not. I would lean into the movies library, like the TCM maybe. And so that's how you do get a premium, but keep HBO Max. And certainly it's more brand equity than Paramount Plus.
For sure. I'm okay with keeping it HBO Max. I think in the end, HBO is the brand that they need to be. Unless they've got some sort of pretensions of having it be like a premium tier or something like that. I think that's the right thing to do. I think it's a better streaming service. It's a better product. It's been better for a while, just getting out of, and Paramount, like, look, this is an inside baseball kind of thing too. Paramount as a brand is not very good. It's not. CBS was a better brand, I would argue, right? Like, CBS meant something 100%. To a lot of people in the United States. It meant something.
Just like NBC did before they mecked it up with Peacock.
It reminds me, like, 20 years ago, I was in a movie theater waiting to see a movie, and they're playing like music on the pre-show entertainment channel or whatever, just to fill the space before it was completely filled with TV commercials. And the announcer would come on and they would say what the song was, the artist was, and then they would say what their record company was, what their record label was. And I thought, wow, what an egomaniac somebody was to say that any listener of music cares what label a record a performer is on.
Well,
calling your streaming service Paramount Plus, I'm sorry, it's a little bit like that. Like most people don't say, "Oh man, I love a Paramount movie." Yeah, they just
you're not
don't.
You're not A24 guys. You're not Miramax.
It's not
in the
a direct
80s.
To consumer brand.
It's, no,
I know
it's
they,
not.
I
it
know
was,
that everybody
yeah,
with
total
Paramount
ego.
On their business card wants to think that everybody knows Paramount.
Total
yeah,
ego.
I'm a fan that knows. Like I know that Paramount means Star Trek and it meant Raiders of the Lost Ark until they got bought by that got bought out by Disney. But like the idea of Paramount as a brand, it's nonsense. HBO is a direct-to-consumer brand. It's a good brand. And Max has been around long enough now that it's a little tag. Apple puts a little tag on the end of every one of their products now, too. It's fine. You know, MacBook Pro, MacBook Air, MacBook Neo, like HBO Max, great. iPhone Pro Max, it's great. But, like, that's the brand. That's your direct-to-consumer brand.
Sure.
It doesn't make any sense.
It was all ego. And then, but again, it fits right into the whole Sherry and all the other people over, Paramount won back CBS and they consolidated it. Just, it never made any sense.
No.
I mean, look, CBS All Access wasn't the best name, but CBS Max, CBS Ultra, CBS Plus, all would have made sense. And by the way, if I were Peacock, I mean, maybe it's done, but the fact is NBC still has some equity. I would be, you know, And by the way, you could have also argued that, you know, had Disney not had, someone said this to me, I forget who, but, had Disney not had all the ownership questions that they had with Hulu, right? When they took over Hulu, they didn't really own Hulu for like 5 years because Comcast had a big chunk of it. So they couldn't really integrate it as much. They couldn't claim ownership and you know, everything had to be checked and they didn't really have it. But had they gone in from day one of that merger with Fox, you know, the Hulu name probably could have just been sunsetted or just as a little tile and it could have been just Disney Plus.
Of course.
ABC. But,
that's where they're going to end up.
Well, yeah, exactly. It would have made a lot more sense. But, you know, I still think, you know, Peacock should, well, maybe I'm wrong on this, but they've spent so much on Peacock, it has some equity. But to me, just call it NBC Plus. Call it NBC Max.
They just said they have no goal of expanding outside the U.S., that their goal is to be in the U.S. If that's true, you might as well just call it NBC.
Yeah, exactly. And make your affiliates happy and just work to, and to me, again, I also, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we get off of this topic and start to wrap up the show, I have a bullet point here. It's the CNN of it all. Is the other part of this is they're going to get CNN, which, as I said earlier, Donald Trump's very excited about, and there's CBS News. So this is the thing that people have been talking about this for like 15, 20 years about.
Could
you fit CNN and CBS News together? I guess we're going to find out.
This was always, people at CBS used to always talk about why they sort of wanted Warner Brothers for many reasons. I mean, obviously, for the longest time, CBS was run by Leslie Moonves, who we don't speak about in polite company now.
No, not anymore.
We knew about him. But the thing is, he was the successful Warner Brothers TV executive for many years, who helped develop Friends and ER and Sisters. And so, you know, there was always this sense like, oh, these assets work well. See, Warner Brothers didn't have a broadcast network. They sort of had half ownership with the WB,
right,
which then became the CW. So everyone always said, like, it would make so much sense because CBS and CNN, and they could, you know, and CBS was third place. So CBS, still third place in daytime, in the morning, in CBS News, rather, still is in third place everywhere except for Sunday at 7 o'clock with 60 Minutes. So, you know, to me, what this means is that you will see massive overlap and mergers, and you know, it's going to mean a gutting of CBS. And I do think, to me, it makes sense that, you know, you have CNN reporters filing for the CBS Evening News, it's already gutted so much that I don't think it'll make much difference, except maybe you will have some stronger coverage, but you certainly back office. You don't need to have multiple studios. There's no reason to have a whole CBS studio broadcast when they can just, for the amount of shows they do, they can just be in the same building.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. And honestly, I wonder at some point, like, you know, the CBS Evening News, maybe it makes sense if that's just, you know, you can't quite, I don't think you can, I don't think affiliates will allow you to put, you know, CNN Today at 6:30 and the Evening News. I think it probably still stays the CBS Evening News, but, you know, maybe there is some sort of cross-platform stuff. I don't know. Or it'll just be much more low budget.
NBC and MSNBC News has had crossover and then they had separation. And I mean, the MSNBC is now MS Now and is on Versant and is gone. But like there's crossover stuff there, and there's, you know, Anderson Cooper quit 60 Minutes. Well,
he'll probably stay off it, and he just whether he stays at CNN. But it's the real question is what role Barry, what how they structure this new stuff. You know, David Ellison was talking about independence, but I don't think he really meant, he meant independence, and that, oh, I'm not going to dictate the stories,
right.
Which no, he's not going to. But if he puts Barry Weiss in charge of CNN too,
she'll do it.
Then she will. I don't think they would be that dumb, but you never know.
You never know. We'll see. That's where we say that, you know, the story is over, but actually it's just begun. And that's the beauty of having a continuing podcast, is we'll have more to talk about, but at least the purchase thing is done, more or less. And that's good. I think I'm glad.
I'm waiting for the announcement that somehow this David Ellison has had conversations with Jeff Zucker, and Jeff Zucker is going to take control of CBS CNN News, because it could happen.
It could happen.
I just had this thought in this conversation, but Jeff is opportunistic.
And he's worked. Is he involved with Jerry Cardin?
He's with Redbird, yes.
Yeah,
so
see?
You know, so there's definitely that, and some other stuff he's done. They've just did a whole new deal. Like he's involved in like this massive reality TV production companies in Europe. Like they own like 200 different little independent production companies now, so they're massive. Wow. Everything from The Traders to Big Brother. So yeah, we'll see what Jeff wants to do next. But I think Jeff would love nothing more than to get back. And by the way, it won't be a bad thing, because Jeff Zucker, for reasons that elude me, maybe he just wrote great paychecks, but is beloved at a lot of people at CNN lifers. It would restore some credibility, you know, but yeah.
All right. I have a listener letter. This is from Nicholas, who says, greetings from the rainy 206. In our recent Olympics watch on Peacock, some events had venue feeds, which were slightly different video edit and no announcers except for what was on the PA. About as close to being there as you can get. What are the reasons why this isn't an option for more sports at the Olympics or beyond? For ones that have it, like MLB.TV, why did they take it away? I mean, some of it is just have to do with what the production feeds are. The Olympics have certain feeds that they do where there's a venue feed. Remember, the Olympics is basically a single production for an international broadcast feed, and then it can be customized very slightly by international broadcasters. So there's a lot of just sort of like things that are furnished by the Olympics, and it's great if it's furnished by them, Peacock can put them on. I love that idea. But
I love the venue. I love the venue feed too. And yeah. I think it was available for almost every sport or most events, but maybe not. It's so hard to tell, because as great as the Peacock coverage was, and the app offered a lot, it still was awful difficult sometimes to find things. And of course it was their interest to push you over to their feed, because they, you know, and it may even have more at commercials. I don't know. But yeah, I think it was a great thing.
And for others too, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, it's an effort to create a clean feed or something like that. And then you have to choose to do it. I think that in the long run, I'm a big fan of altcasts and giving people more control over what they see. And I hope that we see more of that. But in the end, a lot of times it's just like, will it take time or attention or money to do an additional thing, especially if there's a single broadcaster who's making a single product.
Didn't Apple do this with baseball? Didn't they for their MLB games? Didn't they have sort of, or was it just that they did their feed, but with local
radio
announcers?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what it is. That's what
sort
it is. But I love it. Yeah. I would love an option to do natural sound, or even like just as you're there kind of a look, but we'll see. I do love the fact though, that there's an Olympic broadcast center, and Formula One is like this too. It means that you've got this sort of like single entity that's giving you everything. And that means that sometimes you get more things than you might expect, because the Olympic broadcasting is not making every final decision for every broadcaster. And so there's like a menu of content that they feed. And if you're Peacock, you could just plow it all into the Peacock app. That's a lot of fun. Usually those decisions get made up front by NBC at the Super Bowl or whatever. And they make those decisions, and they decide what the outputs are. And that's all you get. But in something
so
like this,
much of an option. Yeah.
There's a whole other layer. TV pick time, Joe. What's your TV pick for us?
Well, you know, I love the Traders format. I don't so much love the Peacock all reality star version of Traders. You know, the first edition when it was mixed was the best in my mind. And since they've gone to all reality stars, I've gotten progressively less interested in, as it looks like there's, you know, the Bravo producers who work on the show with the UK production company pushed to sort of set their storylines. Love Island
people.
Is huge. So Love Island, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched this season, you know, the Love Island people go far. So I am much more of a fan of the UK version and other international versions. The UK version, their main version that airs on the BBC is with all real people every season. They did have a celebrity version that was actual celebrities, not just reality stars, that aired this fall. That was great, and I love that. But season four of the BBC's latest season of Traitors came on Peacock a week ago, right after the US version wrapped up, and I'm only halfway through it, but instantly within the first 15 minutes of watching it, I had more entertaining moments than the entire season four on the US, which I also watched every single week, most on Thursday nights. It's entertaining. It was just really junk foody, and it was ultimately not very satisfying. And all I kept thinking is, like, this could be so much better, and I don't care about these people. Whereas in the UK version, you get not only to get the format of the show and the gameplay of the show and the great host, in this case, it's Claudia Winkleman, who's a UK sort of institution in the Alan Cumming role, but you also get to meet new people. And it goes back to what reality TV was so good at from day one of Survivor, yes. which is like really, truly ordinary people, how they react in these weird situations. Mm-hmm. And people are fascinating, and seeing how the people you least expect do the dumbest things and sometimes the smartest things. And that's what the Traitors UK offers. While I haven't watched the whole season, I can highly recommend season four. I also know I've reported this. We're going to get three seasons of the Traitors Canada, probably sometime next month or by May. So that'll be three more seasons. And then, of course, in September-ish, we're going to get all civilian version of the Traitors on NBC, which most people will watch on Peacock. It would be nice if they are live at the same time, but they won't because of the stupid affiliates. And because it's on NBC, we probably won't be able to get unchecked swear words. And probably the episodes will also be shorter because it's NBC, unless they go for an hour and a half. So that's good news. If you like real people playing real reality show games, then the Traitors UK Peacock.
So when I was in London last fall, I was back at the hotel at the end of the day, and it was the Celebrity Traitors finale.
Oh my God.
And it was great. I've never seen the show before. And I was like, and I still haven't seen it, but I was like, I get it. I get why this is an interesting show. Really, really interesting. Having seen enough of the US show to be like, no, the US Celebrity Traitors, it's like, no, thank you. I do not like those people. I do not want to see these awful people doing whatever shtick they're doing because they're celebrity reality messes. But like the UK version is excellent. So
yeah, it's so good. You should definitely check it out. And and by the way, the ratings there are so much more just huge. And the fact that NBC and Universal didn't learn that lesson and immediately put the show on NBC with real people 2 years ago is beyond me.
That's very weird. Very weird. Okay, my two picks really quick are two returning Apple TV shows. I'm just going to mention Shrinking is on now. I've seen a little bit more than it's actually aired yet because I've got screeners for that. So I'm a little bit ahead. It's a great show.
I love it so much.
It's just killing it. This is the third season, and it's just so good. Everybody is good in it. It's a great, you know, Bill Lawrence hangout show. All the characters are fun. Great performance from Harrison Ford. Really great performance from Harrison Ford. Great cameos from or very small part from Michael J. Fox because of Harrison Ford's storyline. Ted McGinley, famous show killer.
Good.
He's so great. Christina Lawrence, and of course the primaries are all there and are great, and like it's just a good show top to bottom. It's not just a Jason Segel vehicle. It is really an ensemble, and it's so good.
One of my top five shows on TV. I love it so much. I watch it. I have screeners, but I watch week to week. No spoilers, please. Yeah. But it's so well done. It also makes a few more episodes than most.
I think they've got like 11 or something.
Last year was 12.
And the first one was two. So it basically is the same as last year.
It comes back every year as opposed to every 2 years, which is great. It's just a delight. And it's not just a hang show anymore too. It goes deep as well. And
you get that pleasant, like people just hanging out it's nice. They do things and there's important stuff that goes on.
It's the sequel to Cougar Town that I've been hoping for all this time.
It's really good. All right. That brings us to the end. If you have a question or suggestion for us, go to downstreamfeedback.com. We love to hear from you. Love to your mothers. If you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to Downstream Plus and supporting us. This episode, you got to hear it all. It was a full-sized episode for everyone, but the only way to hear the complete version of probably our next episode and hear ad-free episodes is to subscribe and support us. Downstream.plus is where you can do that. Without you, there would be no podcast. Trust me on that. You can find me at sixcolors.com. I appear on many other podcasts here at Relay and at theincomparable.com. And you can find Joe at Vulture. And the buffering newsletter is free. And I think if you search for Vulture Buffering, people will find it, right, Joe?
Yes, you can. And you can also find me on Blue Sky at TVMOJOE. Yeah. TV Mojo.
TV Mojo, do it. And I'm on Blue Sky. It's snell.zone. So you could do that if you really want to. And we'll be back next time. But until then, goodbye. Thanks for listening.